Well, welcome everybody. It's not my birthday today, but it was yesterday. That's, yeah. Yep, I am 25. So, now I had my 41st birthday yesterday. Nice day, just kicking back with the kids. Pizza for dinner. I mean, what else can you need, you know, when you're 41 years old? So, it was a nice thing. And it's our eldest elder has his birthday on Friday, and our illustrious gray-haired sound man back there has his birthday today. So wish Kenny a birthday. We're like the three amigos in November, you know what I mean? Like right next to each other, you know, boom, boom, boom. So that's good. Hey, today I want to start off, and I want to think about, bring a topic back that I occasionally bring up that I like to call bumper sticker theology. You know, because anytime you go out there and you're going to see bumper stickers and they're going to make theological statements, and, you know, usually when somebody does the bumper sticker, you know, it's kind of like they think that that one little phrase, that one little statement is enough to do everything. You know, they stand up there, they do the bumper sticker, and it's like, mic drop. You know, I'm going to walk away and just leave it there. And occasionally what we find is that bumper sticker theology is just insufficient. Bumper sticker theology doesn't go quite far enough, but it's catchy. And sometimes we've got to catch these things. So to introduce our sermon today, we're continuing in the book of Ecclesiastes. But I want to share with you a bumper sticker that I encountered. And there's a story behind this one. When I was a youth pastor, one of the youth students who'd grown up in the church married another one of the youth group students. And our senior pastor at that time performed the wedding for them and that kind of stuff. But we got to go to the reception. And I remember they had the reception over at the Sheraton over at Greenway and I-17. You know, many of you have driven by that, and they had a nice little reception hall in there and that kind of stuff. And so Melissa and I drove, and as we were walking through the parking lot, I walked by a car that had this bumper sticker on it. And I got incensed. I wanted to write a note and put it on the windshield and all this kind of stuff. And you can check and see, here's what it said. It said, if money is the root of all evil, why do churches beg for it? Ooh. Now, I'll tell you what, let me just say that the implication of this is that churches are hypocritical about money, right? I mean, that's really what this is getting at. And let me just say that at the outset, that's not what ticked me off, okay? I mean, I've seen that so many times. I'm used to this perspective, and I'm going to blame it on all of the televangelists that are on TV, wearing Armani suits, Rolex watches, you know, driving fancy cars, having multi-million dollar homes, and going there on their private jets. There's something that's incongruent with the Christian life in that kind of perspective. And I'll tell you, the thing that upset me was that the verse that this is based on says that exact same thing. There's something wrong with it. This comes from 1 Timothy 6:10. But look at what's different. It's not money, it's the love of money is a root of all kinds of evils. And it warns that it is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pains. Money is a neutral thing, but our attitude towards money is a big deal. Our attitude towards money is going to go a lot to define the kind of person that we are. And whether you're a Christian, whether you're a non-Christian, if your attitude towards money is wrong, it's a serious deal. We continue our sermon series in the book of Ecclesiastes, and what we're looking at is another passage, another section in the book of Ecclesiastes dealing with money. If you've got your Bible, turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. We're going to start in verse 8 and look at that. And a couple of things that I want to say about this. First of all, those of you who have been with us through our series in Ecclesiastes are like, wait a second, we've talked about money before in the book of Ecclesiastes. You're right. We have. This is one of those things, if you think about it, a preoccupation that we have with money is something that people have had throughout all stages of human history. Jesus spent a lot of time, those of you who are here for our Gospel of Luke sermon series, Jesus talked about money a lot. It's something that we can't live without. We've got to learn to have a right perspective on it. But our preacher in the book of Ecclesiastes is going to be looking at money from two different perspectives, perspectives that have characterized the way that he has looked at all other aspects of life in the book. On the one hand, he says, there's an under-the-sun perspective. he's artificially limited his look at our experiences in life by what occurs under the sun. His question is, if we look at life just in terms of it, on its terms, and assume there's nothing else out there, there's no God, there's no higher power or anything like that, what do we get? And the answer is kind of sad. You don't get a lot. The conclusion is that it's vanity. But implicit in that is a contrasting view, a view that says, what if we see God? How then does that change things? That's what he's going to do today as we look at the issue of loving money. So a couple things we want to see, and let me go ahead and read this. I meant to do that, and then I got so excited about talking about it. So let me go from there. Starting in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 8. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase to eat them. And what advantage has the owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much. But the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. And those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is the father of the son, but has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, he shall go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him. For this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and the power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. There is evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires. Yet God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things. And he also has no burial. I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness his name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to one place. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. Whatever has come to me has already been named, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity, and what advantage to them? For who knows what is good for man while he lives a few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow. For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? This is a long section, and it's split into two bits. We're going to look at the two negative bits first, and then look at that nice positive bit that's sandwiched in between, that I think helps us to be able to see a bigger perspective on the dangers in loving money. First thing I want to look at, under the sun, in this life, when we look at this life only, preoccupation with wealth has several nasty results. It often leads to corruption. It does not satisfy. It does not relieve stress, and it does not grant security. Those are all the things that we think that if we get lots of money, we finally get enough, we're going to have, you know, security. We're not going to have the cares and concerns that we have right now. That it is going to satisfy and all of that. And what the preacher says
is actually the opposite of what occurs. Look what he says in verse 8. He talks about the oppression of the poor. And he talks about it in terms of that there are high officials that are watched by higher officials who are in turn watched by higher officials that are involved in this. One of the things that he's getting at is that when we see corruption and we see oppression, that oftentimes what that involves is levels, a network of corruption. It's not just one person trying to get greedy on this. That oftentimes it's a bunch of cronies that are all in, that are all part of the system, they're all working together to be able to do this. And what they're doing, this group is protecting one another's backs. Greed, love of money, has motivated them to step on other people to get what they want. We've got a number of examples of this in the real world. You know, those of you who know some of the history of some of the oppression in Central America could watch how a ruling elite aligned with security forces and death squads, anybody who tried to speak against the corruption in the system got whacked, them and their family. It's a tremendously oppressive kind of regime, and we see that again and again and again when cronies are supporting one another and they're basically getting gain at the expense of other people. That's what this leads to. Loving money will sometimes lead to an oppressive kind of government. Another thing that we see in verses 10 through 12, he who loves money, it says in verse 10, will not be satisfied with money. And so here's one of the things. The love of money is something that doesn't bring fulfillment. You know, we think, man, I'm so worried about, you know, how I'm going to get this bill paid and how I'm going to get this bill paid. And we're juggling those sorts of things. We think, man, if I had enough money, man, life would be so much easier. Everything would be perfect. The truth is, really? The preacher doesn't think so. In his experience, and something that's borne out today again and again, that when somebody says, well, if I just have enough, I'll be fine. What's enough? Can anybody ever get enough? Well, if the desire is, well, I want to get more and more and more, you know, you're not training yourself to say, well, as soon as I get this point, it'll be enough. Because once you get that point, you feel like, well, I need to get just a little bit more. But there's another side that goes along with this. Is that if we think, well, if I get enough, then my stress will be relieved. What the preacher looks at and goes on to say is that there is no decrease of stress. When goods increase, he says, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see with his eyes? When you increase your goods, there tends to be higher costs associated with maintaining what you have. Taxes increase for you. And somehow or another, there's that perpetual circle of groupies that hang around with you because they're going to let you pay their way. You know, I mean, hey, they want to hang out with you. They want to ride your coattails and enjoy the good food that you're going to be able to provide for them. And so when you let that happen, instead of decreasing your stress, it actually increases it. Cares and worries of that then spill over into one's personal life. Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. The cares and concerns, you know, did I do this? Or, oh, I need to make sure I do that. And all of those sorts of things to maintain and to grow your wealth continues to rob people of sleep. There's a story told about John Rockefeller. Was once asked, how much is enough? His response was classic. He said, just a little more. Just a little more. At the age of 53, he was the world's only billionaire. He brought in millions of dollars a week. You're like, we'll never see $1 million. And maybe in our lifetime, if you add up everything, he got that in a week. He was a sick man who lived on crackers and milk and could not sleep because of worry. That only changed when he started giving his money away. That's when his health turned around. That's when he lived to celebrate his 98th birthday. It's an amazing thing. Here's a guy that thought, if I just, you know, get more and more, it will work. And at the age of 53, he was the richest man in the world. It didn't work out for him. And only when he changed his perspective on wealth did he finally begin to experience some of the joy that can come from wealth on this side of eternity. The preacher goes on to say in verses 13 through 17 that the love of money never brings security. He talks about the guy who hoards wealth. You know, this is the person that's like, no, I can't spend anything. I can't let anything go out. And because of that, he never actually used his wealth. And then in one, you know, just fell swoop, there's a situation where his riches, it says in verse 14, were lost in a bad venture. How many people, when they put all their eggs in one basket, that one bad investment causes a loss of everything? And the person was working so hard, trying to save, trying to do something, and boom, that was it. It's gone. It's his hope. Our hope is in money. This is exactly the kind of thing that can happen to us. You know, I remember watching back in 2008, 2009, you know, remember when the Great Recession hit? And people who had put, you know, I mean, they had their retirement built up, they're going to go live, you know, live large. And all of a sudden in this recession, the value of their retirement stocks and all that kind of stuff plummeted. We're done. You know, I mean, there were suicides, you know, increased greatly because people realized, wow, I'm going to have to go back to work. All of my plans have fallen through. People have been swindled. You know, think of the Bernie Madoffs who have taken people's life savings. They will never get that back. The preacher looks at that and says, you know, that's a grievous evil. This is the kind of thing that happens. But it's something that's made infinitely worse when we put our trust in those finances. When we put our trust in the size of our bank account and expect that that's the thing that's going to give us security. That that's the thing that's going to relieve stress. That that's the thing that's going to satisfy. We're betting on the wrong horse if we do that, he says. And he closes that section saying that we can't take it with us. Naked we came into the world, naked we're going to leave it. There are no pockets in our funeral shrouds. Chapter 6, he picks up with a couple of other perspectives that we want to look at. Under the sun, he says, those who achieve success often are unable to enjoy it because of their rejection of God. Because of the inevitability of death and their inability to be grateful for what they have. We look at verse 1. There's an evil that I have seen. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires. Sounds like that's a good guy. Yet God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is a person who has wealth, possessions, and honor. It goes on to describe a person who has lots of children. You know, back in the day, children were a sign of God's blessing. People wanted lots of children. Usually us were like, no, I don't want to have so many. You know, let's cap that at like 2, 3, or, you know, maybe that's it. 1, you know, 0, right? But back in the day, you know, in this time period, that was a sign of success. That was something that people wanted to do. They wanted abundance of children. They wanted long life. These qualities define the fortunate or the lucky person. And so, you know, you would look and you would expect somebody that has the wealth, that's got the children and the descendants, that's got the long life and all that kind of stuff going together, that person is the one that is going to be blessed, that's going to be fortunate. That's the person you want to be. But what's interesting is that it says in verse 2, God does not give the person power to enjoy these things. Why doesn't God do that? Why doesn't God allow him to experience the joy of what he's earned? And what we find is that the description of this person is the person who fails to acknowledge that the gifts have come from God. This is the person who thinks, I've put these together on my own. I don't see God in the picture at all. And because of that, if we do not acknowledge that good things come from God, why would we expect God to give us the ability to enjoy those good things? It just doesn't make sense. Why would God, you know, give that blessing and then us say, you know, not even thanks, but just, all right, well, let me enjoy it. Look at what my hands have done. That's not something that honors God. That's something that's a profound disappointment to him. And so when you look at this person who should be blessed, that should be fortunate, the preacher looks at it and says, you know what? A stillborn child is better off than this guy. Because this guy's going to have all this and it's not going to benefit him at all. A stillborn child doesn't know any better. Just rest. This guy doesn't. In verse 7, all the toil of a man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. which speaks of the appetite. It's focused on the person who's thinking constantly about what he doesn't have. You know, he's working hard and he's like, oh, I want that, and I want that, and I want that, and I want that. And he's looking around at stuff, hoping that that stuff is going to satisfy him. He's not appreciative of what he does have. He doesn't think about that as a blessing. It's always about what he doesn't have. And that's why the secret of the wise man, the secret of the poor man who is rightly related to the world, is this in verse 8. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. Right? Better is what is real and what is actually in front of us than what we continually wish that we had and never are able to get. That will drive us crazy. There's something that we want and we can't get it. And we're so focused on that that we ignore what's right in front of us. And finally, something that's always also been a recurring theme in the book of Ecclesiastes is this fear of death. In verse 6, it talks about that even though the person, this fortunate person, should live 1,000 years twice over, longer than anybody in the Old Testament ever lived, even Methuselah didn't quite make 1,000, right? But even if he should live 2,000 years, the most blessed sign of life that you could imagine, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to one place. It talks about in verse 12, the few days of man's vain life pass like a shadow. Point is, most of us don't live 2,000 years. Most of us are lucky if we get to 100. Life is short, and the future is uncertain. All of this points to the idea that humanity has no advantage. It says in verse 10, whatever has come to be has already been named, and it's known by what man is. It's a reminder, in Hebrew, the name man is the word Adam. We get our name Adam from it. But Adam is a word that comes from the word for dirt, dust, Adama. It's a perpetual reminder for us. When we talk about humanity, our very name given by God speaks of a time when we will return to that dust from which we were taken. Kind of a downer at this point, you know. Yeah, we pray and, you know, go have a great day, right? No, I saved the best point for last, so I wouldn't do that to you. Because what we see is that when we look at these dangers of loving money, there is another perspective that this preacher presents. He would be rightly kind of a downer if he didn't offer this corrective. And he sandwiches it right between his discussion of these two dimensions of wealth used poorly. What he says is, from the perspective of faith, life can be enjoyed as a gift from God. We understand it as a gift from God. It changes the way that we approach everything. If we don't think of money as something that I've earned, that I need to acquire to be able to get what I want, but we think of money as something that God has blessed me with. Yeah, I've had my work that's gone into it, but it's the blessing of God. We have a perspective to be able to appreciate it that is not pessimistic anymore, but it's very positive. Let's look at 5. I just want to read 5:18-20. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him. For this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. Joy in his heart. There's a picture of a joyful life here where one can eat and drink and be satisfied and enjoy the work that one is doing. But the key characteristic from this, the one that separates this from the other two descriptions that sandwich it, is that God is mentioned 4 times in this passage. This is relayed as something that is the gift of God, not something that somebody is able to produce on their own power, but something that people are able to put together because God has blessed them. And they understand, they're the people that walk around thinking, it's not, hey, look at what I've made for myself, but look how God has blessed me. And because of that awareness of God, there's a genuine ability to enjoy life. There's a gratefulness instead of the desire for what I don't have. I'd like to real quick just throw a couple of practical suggestions out there. One of the things I think this passage challenges us to do, and I encourage you to read through and to think about it, we need to reorient ourselves towards God's purposes. Right, when God gives us the two greatest commandments, remember what they are? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. And the second is, love your neighbor as yourself. Guys, here's the deal. This is what we were made to do. You know, from the very, very beginning in the Garden of Eden, God wanted and created humanity to have a relationship with Him. He created them to have a relationship with each other, a relationship that was unbroken. That's the kind of picture that God initially wanted for us. And the reason that seeking after wealth, love of money, success, all of those sorts of things are never going to fully satisfy us is because we were made for far more. When we settle for success, when we settle to get a particular kind of income, we are settling. We were made for this. And we're satisfied with this. We find out that we're not really satisfied with that, but we settle for that. Wealth, possessions, success, all of the things that the way we would define that are insufficient to fulfill our purpose. And yet we try so hard in our culture to find things that are going to substitute for that. You know, for real relationships, we substitute sex. For, you know, love of God and a higher purpose, wealth and power are the things we put in their place. Those three things become, I think, the greatest modern idols that we worship. We're worshiping our own appetite. We're worshiping, you know, some future that we hope to be able to get, and we're missing out on what God has for us. We need to reorient ourselves if we've gotten off track. The second thing is that if we have gotten off track, we need to confess that to Him. Change the way that we relate and think about wealth and success and people. If we've adopted that wrong thinking, we need to get back on track. You know, it's often said that we can summarize, you know, a biblical perspective, bumper sticker theology now, but work with me, this is a good one, right? Love people and use things. Stuff that we have is a tool. Stuff is a tool that we can use in this world that can bring benefit and joy. And you know, even the passage can talk about that. We can enjoy those things. We shouldn't feel guilty if God has blessed us. We should celebrate what God has blessed us with. But here's the deal. In our culture, we turn that around. Instead of loving people and using things, we love things and we use people to get them. That's where we need to get down on our knees and confess that if that's the kind of wrong thinking, if we have bought into this kind of thing, the things of other people, only in terms of what they can do for us, only in terms of their economic value, man, we need to get down on our knees, we need to confess that, and we need to begin reorienting ourselves in the Lord. Third point, we need to understand that wealth by itself is neither good nor evil. The love of wealth is the problem. In 1 Timothy 6:10, it's very, very interesting that the word, you know, when it said money, if money is the root of all evil, it's not even possible as a translation of 1 Timothy 6:10. Because there is no word for money in 1 Timothy 6:10. The only word there is the word that means love of money. That's one word in Greek. That's the thing that can become a snare for those of us who put our hope and our trust in that. What this passage tells us, and there's other passages peppered throughout Scripture, the freedom to eat, to drink, to work, and to accumulate wealth are gifts of God. The things that He wants us to be able to enjoy before Him. The issue is not that those things are bad. It's not that Christians need to take a vow of poverty or something like that. That's not what God intended. God intended us for enjoy what He provided for us, but to keep our hearts in the right place about it. If we're focused on acquiring more and more, if our goal is to acquire more and more money, we are not serving God. We're not being grateful for Him. We have made money and wealth and possessions an idol. And that's what's being condemned. That's what Paul condemns later on in 1 Timothy 6. That's what the preacher is condemning here. We have to guard our hearts against greed. And that means sometimes we do have to say no to something. There are some things that are going to cross the line for us. And that line's going to be different for you and for me. You know, there are some things that you would be like, oh, I must have. And I'm like, eh, whatever. But then I have my things that I'm like, shut up and take my money. And, and then you'd be like, yeah, whatever, you know. Star Wars stuff, you know. So, anyway, just had to throw that out there for Andrew because he needs, if I don't have one Star Wars reference, you know, the sermon's like wasted, I know. So, we get to our final point, and I'd like to ask, the choir is going to sing for us here at the end of service. I'm going to ask them to stand up. So they're not walking out on us. They're just getting ready to do that. But one final point I think that we need to look at is that we need to make gratitude a regular part of our prayer and our thought life. I heard a story in one of the commentaries that I was reading about a man, and let's just call him Joe. He was very disgruntled with his life. He was unhappy with his wife and his job, and there had been some recent increases in property taxes that had sent him into a tailspin of depression. He finally decided that he was going to make an appointment to speak with his pastor. Prior to the meeting, the pastor had requested that Joe write down all of his disappointments. What are the things that's getting you down? At the top of his list were job, and property taxes. So as the meeting began, the pastor said to him, "Man, Joe, I'm so very sorry to hear that your wife passed away." And Joe was like, "What? She didn't pass away. I mean, she made me breakfast this morning and I'm here right now. Oh, my mistake. Okay, well, then I'm very, very sorry to hear that you got laid off from your job." Joe was like, "Whoa, no. I mean, laid off. I got a raise and you know, the company's doing really well. My last review was really good and that kind of stuff." And, "Okay. Well, then I'm very sorry to hear that your house burned down." By this point, Joe was catching on to what the pastor was doing. Joe was so focused on what he didn't have. Joe was so focused on what was missing from his life that he had ignored what was right in front of him. That he had not been grateful for the wife that God had provided, the job that has provided abundantly for his needs, the house that he was able to live in, and all the other things that were going on. It's easy to forget God's blessings. It's easy to be so focused on what we don't have to want more because that's what we're focused on. But let me tell you, that is an attitude that is fundamentally an attitude of greed. And the way we can combat greed is by being thankful and grateful for what we have. Turning to God and saying, "God, you know what? You've not caused me to win the lottery yet." That really surprised for me. I haven't ever played the lottery. So if God did want me to win the lottery, you know, he'd have to make that happen in a pretty miraculous way. But when I look and I say, "God, here's what you've provided for me, and I'm thankful about that," it's amazing how much my heart stops wanting the stuff that's out there. My soul is in the right place when I'm focused on Him and I'm grateful for all that He's done. I want to leave you with that thought today. I'll ask the choir to come up, and they're gonna sing for us. And I'm going to pray for us just here briefly while they do get set up. I want to encourage you today that if this is something that you're struggling with, if you find yourself, you know, feeling that you feel like you don't have enough, feel like, you know, that you're trying to satisfy yourself with more stuff. Oh, if I just have this little bit right here, I'll be happy. I'll be content. I want to challenge you that I think you're going to find that that's a short-term gain, maybe, but it's definitely going to be a long-term loss. Satisfaction is not going to be found there. It can't be found there because there is only one place that we can find satisfaction, and it's in what we were made for. Let me pray for you. Father, it's a reminder that we need, because it's so easy for us to get distracted in this life with all of the shiny distractions, particularly in our materialistic and wealthy culture. It's so easy for us to get drawn away from simple, humble devotion to you. It's so easy for us to replace people and relationships with things, thinking that they're far less complex, that they're far easier to get along with, that they will be things to make us happy, that it won't be as much work. Father, I pray that you help us to recognize the fallacy of that kind of thinking. That will never satisfy us. The only thing that can satisfy us is you. And fulfilling the purpose that you made for us, which involves a relationship with you and also deep and abiding relationships with others. Father, I pray that you help us to see that. I pray that you help us not to fall into that trap of thinking that we can find satisfaction on our own through our own effort. Help us be grateful, Father. And if we've not been, if we've looked past the blessings that we have, Father, we want to take that time right now and we want to say thank you. We want to commit to being even more grateful as the days and years go on, to start a day off even with that. So that we're not people that are focused on trying to get more, but people who are exceedingly grateful for all of your blessings, honest. We ask this in the name of your Son. Amen.